I know that there are lots of people who will never read my work or see me perform or step in the room because I'm Arab American. And those same people will come see a veteran tell their story. And if in some way we are saying the same thing through our stories about war and violence and peace and the future, then I feel like change is possible.
You're listening to Creating Place, a podcast by Alternate Roots about the art of equitable community building. I'm Free For All.
And I'm Bonnie Gable. Each episode, we're bringing you stories of creative placemaking in the U.S. South.
Today, we're talking about Art to Action. Andrea Saff started producing work under the name Art to Action in the early 2000s. Now, it has evolved into a multifaceted production company with a mission to create, develop, produce, and present original theater, interdisciplinary performances, performative acts, and progressive cultural organizing. They support women artists, artists of color, queer and trans artists, and creative allies.
They're currently located in Tampa, Florida, and a lot of their work right now revolves around issues of war and peace. Here's Andrea.
Art to Action has kind of three major areas of work. One is the creation, development, and production of original work, often touring, which I'm usually involved in some way as an artist. The other major area of work is cultural organizing for community-based initiatives in which we're working with artists who are not necessarily self-identifying as artists or not working as professional artists yet, and working in collaboration or in co-creation with professional artists. And another main area of work is through a partnership with the University of South Florida. We've done some presenting, and we're now an NPN partner.
Andrea grew up all over the East Coast, landing in New York to study theater. She stayed there about 12 years, during which time she worked on experimental theater and she wrote. She's a poet as well as an actor and director.
And she's Lebanese American. In the wake of 9/11 and all the ugliness that has thus ensued for Middle Eastern Americans and people in the Middle East, she found her writing revolved around some similar themes. She eventually compiled some of that writing for a theater piece called 11 Reflections on September.
11 Reflections on September is a poetry-based multimedia theater collaboration. It's not a play in the conventional sense. I knew that it had to be a multimedia piece because the media has been such a huge and crucially important and sometimes horribly detrimental part of the post-9/11 experience. The media design was done by Pramila Vasudevan, who's the artistic director of Anicca Arts in Minneapolis. It was her idea to use text animation, drawing from the poems themselves, mixed with documentary footage and found images, mixed with kind of abstract movement and images that move. It's a gorgeous design that still travels with the piece, and even though she doesn't travel with the piece, I always feel like she's part of the ensemble. And the experiment that I wanted to try was what would happen if I took that kind of very American spoken word aesthetic, experimental theater traditions that I was trained in, put it together with Middle Eastern music. I really didn't know anything about Middle Eastern music when I started that project, but I knew that it was something that I wanted and needed to do as a kind of part of my own process of identity reclamation and or identity construction as an Arab American artist living in a post-9/11 world, and certainly in the United States. The original ensemble had a musician from Egypt, a vocalist and daft player originally from Iran, and an American guy who just happened to be like mad skilled in Middle Eastern music and plays like 8 instruments. Since then, we've been joined by other percussionists, a violinist who's originally from Turkey, and most recently a Syrian opera singer. Amazing artists that I've had the opportunity to work with this piece, who I feel humbled by every time.
About 7 years ago, Andrea moved to Tampa, Florida.
Tampa was the national headquarters for the KKK until the early 90s, when they were allegedly forced to leave the state due to tax evasion. Central Florida has seen many incidents of anti-Arab terrorism historically as well as in recent times.
What a lot of people don't know, because it doesn't necessarily make national news, is that there have been 5 burnings of mosques in Florida since Trump was elected. During the Trump campaign, we had an incident where a woman was shot at leaving a mosque, and another woman's car was almost run off the road. Tampa is the home of Central Command for U.S. military operations in North Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia. That includes Iraq and Afghanistan. So there is this incredible array of medical facilities for veterans. The University of South Florida is also a veteran reintegration campus. MacDill Air Force Base is here, and it's also a retirement community, and a retirement community that is very welcoming to people retiring from the military. So if you put together all the active duty military personnel, plus the veterans who live here or retire here, plus the people who come for medical services or to go back to school at USF, and their families, you have an enormously high percentage of military community in the Tampa Bay area, nearly 20%, which is extraordinary. At the same time, Central Florida has a very high population of Arab and Middle Eastern and Muslim people from multiple countries. Plus, USF has a very large international student population. The largest groups are from South Asia and the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. And then you add to that that Tampa is a welcome city for refugee relocation. Historically, we have a large Vietnamese community because of refugee relocation post the Vietnam War. And now we have new refugees arriving from Iraq and Syria, as well as, you know, Latin America, Haiti, and kind of all the other groups that arrive to Florida. So when you kind of put that all together in a big picture, here you have a community that has an enormous military presence, an enormous presence of people who've been directly affected by the US military, living together in the same region. So all of that together, for me, makes this a very significant place to do community-based work and to really engage issues of war and peace in a way that's directly relevant to the people who live here. I feel like because of the partnerships we've been able to build with among groups that don't normally work together, we're able to get people into a room to have a transformative experience or a transformative conversation. And that's always the goal with our work.
In 2014, Art to Action received a grant from the Association of Performing Arts Presenters Building Bridges, Campus Community Engagement Grants Program, a component of the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation and Doris Duke Foundation for Islamic Art. Dora Ariola is a professor at the University of South Florida and a board member of Art to Action.
The nature of Building Bridges is the collaboration between a nonprofit organization and a college or university. USF in general, but the School of Theatre and Dance, several professors we are interested in connecting with our community. And sometimes faculty, we don't know how to do that. It's been very helpful to have an organization like Art to Action to help us to connect with the community.
That was Art to Action's first major multi-year national grant. And it actually required a partnership between a nonprofit arts organization and the University of South Florida. And that kind of formalized the relationship between Art to Action and the University of South Florida. And we really have a great time working together. Because Art to Action gets to bring national artists, presenting programs, and workshops to the university that, as a state university in the state of Florida, they might not otherwise be able to afford or provide for their students. And in exchange, the university provides Art to Action with free space and facilities and support from staff and faculty and collaboration. So it's a win-win. For 2.5 years focused on Arab, Middle Eastern, and Muslim artists, and focusing on mostly women-identified artists or projects in which the lead artist was a woman. So we actually started the whole series with comedy, and we brought Nagin Farsad, who is an Iranian-American comedian and film producer and writer, screenwriter. And it was really fun to kick off the whole series with a comedy show.
Other artists in the series included musician Aida Shaksemi, dancer-choreographer Dana Mejia, slam poets Tahani Salah and Amir Rabia, among others. Before the official season started, Andrea wanted to establish partnerships with community organizations. They held a series of events and approached groups they wanted to work with directly about partnering on events in the future. Andrea always tried to establish common ground with whomever she sought partnership, recognizing that not every piece of Art to Action's mission would align with the values of the organization she wanted to work with.
For example, it's stated in our mission that we support artists of color, women, and LGBTQ-identified artists. That's on all of our public materials. So when I approach a faith-based organization like the Muslim Students Association, you know, we had to have a conversation because I know that some of their constituency doesn't necessarily feel comfortable with parts of our mission, right? So when I talked to them about this bridge, I said, for example, you don't necessarily have to support every artist that we bring or every project that we do. You don't have to co-sponsor everything. But if we can hold together this goal of shifting the climate of Islamophobia in our community, then we can be partners in this work.
Andrea is Arab American, but she's not Muslim. She was raised Catholic. During a performance of a play by Lebanese American playwright Layla Buck, early on in the Building Bridges project, she realized some of the ways that theater and the conventions around theater exclude Muslim people. She got a call from a student organizer at the Muslim Students Association.
So they wanted to come, but the presentation happened to be on a Thursday, and there was a large group of Muslim students who were practicing a weekly fast on Thursdays. So that meant on Thursday evenings, after evening prayer, they would break their fast. I scheduled this performance based on, you know, usual theater performance time, 7:30, 8 o'clock, and what was convenient for the theater department. And I did not look up what time is evening prayer. It didn't occur to me.
The student organizer asked for a space inside the theater building to pray and break fast, so they would already be in the building and be able to catch at least part of the play.
But we learned a really big lesson as an organization, like, oh, if you want to engage the Muslim community and you want them to come see theater, you have to look up what time is prayer and make sure that you're not starting the show before the evening prayer, which is one of the most important prayer times, which none of our theaters do. Like, you know, shows always start at 7:30 or 8. Nobody ever pays attention to prayer times. And then they wonder why they don't have the community at their show.
Muslim evening prayer times are related to sunset, so do shift a bit throughout the year, so you need to do a little research to figure it out. And this demonstrates a real desire and effort to include the Muslim community. Andrea accomplished this in other ways as well and with other groups. One of the first student-oriented projects she did with USF was an adaptation of a solo theater piece by artist Heather Raffo called Nine Parts of Desire. Andrea divided the piece among 15 actors, only two of which were Muslim. Andrea says normally, in a professional theater setting, she'd never cast in this way. But in this case, with the permission of the playwright, Andrea did and used the play as a vehicle for cultural education.
But it was not like, here's a script, learn the lines. It was not that kind of process. It was more a process immersed in knowing more about the culture. Some of them, they express that their life changed in the perceptions of the Arab and Muslim culture.
The student cast got to really meet community partners and find out who's in their community. We went to Refugee Welcome Day and did a lot of things, you know, outside of what academic theater department generally considers to be rehearsal. On our very first night of rehearsal, all the actors showed up. And I said, get your things, we're going to a feast with the Muslim Student Association because they were breaking their fast that night. It was the end of Ramadan. And the students were like, we're not rehearsing? Like, what are we doing? The Muslim Student Association was extremely welcoming. They were so excited that non-Muslim students were showing up. And they invited people who wanted to pray with them. And that was really fascinating to watch because some of the students were immediately like, okay, I'll jump in, I'll try, I'll follow along, let's see what this is. And other students were like, I can't participate because of my own religion, I'll just observe. But even the process of negotiating that decision began a process of learning about each other's faith and practices and beliefs throughout the course of the play. And it gave me, as director, an opportunity to really talk about the responsibility of representation and what it is that we do in theater when we take on someone else's identity and what it means to be accountable to community. It was a way for me to teach through experience what community engagement looks like and tackle some of these ethical issues about theater and community work. And the other piece of that that's very important is the community being part of the process. The actual buy-in, participation, and witnessing of the community that's being represented in a way that gives them opportunity to voice any concern.
The script also called for the Adhan, or the Muslim call to prayer, to happen 5 times on stage, which presented a problem, because it's considered a sacrilege to perform the Adhan outside of a religious ceremony. So Andrea consulted the Muslim Students Association.
What was comfortable for them was that a student who is a reciter of the Quran could come before the show begins and recite part of the Adhan, which he did. He'd show up every night before the show, right before we start, in complete Saudi dress and sneakers. He'd recite the beginning of the Adhan, and he'd usually leave. I think he stayed for like one rehearsal and one show. And then he also agreed to record it with us so that when we played it again in the show, it was also his voice. And that was, to me, that was an extraordinary gesture and an extraordinary commitment by a student who was not in any way otherwise engaged in the project, but that was his contribution.
So the show opened on a Thursday, and the next day, Andrea went out of town for a conference featuring some of her other work. That same day were the 2015 attacks in Paris.
The cast had a very difficult weekend doing the show. The non-Arab students, for the first time, started to experience Islamophobic backlash. We had a pickup rehearsal on Tuesday night. I sat down with the cast, we made a big circle on the floor of the stage, and I was like, we're just going to do a check-in, and I want to know how you're feeling and how you're feeling about the show. I said to them, if you feel that you cannot continue to perform this piece this week, tell us now. And so we went around the circle. We had one student who had family in France who was very shaken up. We had some students who were feeling very conflicted, students from very, very Christian families, who in a couple of cases were upset that they were playing Muslims on stage. And then we got to the two Muslim students in the cast, and they started talking about the hate mail and threats and things that they'd been dealing with for the last few days, and how scary and painful that was. And once the rest of the group heard that, the whole conversation shifted to really a realization of what Arab and Muslim people, who they now know and care about, were experiencing. And one by one, everyone went around the room and said, we're doing this show, I'm in. The second weekend of the show, we did talkbacks. The students who had some reservation or fears about continuing to perform the show, partly was they were scared of the talkbacks. That made me realize that what I needed to do as a leader facilitating community engagement was to make sure that the students who were performing as artists on stage had support in the conversation, and that they didn't have to be the experts or put on the spot for questions that they couldn't answer, either because they don't know or because they didn't want to feel targeted. So I got some of our veteran and military partners in the room. I got a couple of activists, one from Iraq Veterans Against the War. Because when you hear a veteran say, thank you for this show, I think you told the truth, or this resonates with what I saw and experienced, or when there's an Iraqi person in the audience who is able to say, I feel respected by your portrayal of my culture, then the tenor of the conversation shifts, right?
Nine Parts of Desire was actually the second piece of Heather Raffo's work to be presented through the Building Bridges Project. The first piece was an opera called Fallujah, for which Raffo wrote the libretto based on interviews she did with an American soldier. During a Q&A, a student asked the playwright if the piece was anti-U.S. military.
And Heather paused and said, when I was young, I had over 100 extended family members in Iraq. Now I have 6. What do you expect me to say? And she said, this is a play about war. And if we don't understand what war really is, we don't have the right to make decisions about war. I think that I assumed that veterans who served in the Middle East would have a particular relationship to the Middle East or Arabs. And I met a veteran who, with tears in his eyes, said, I love the desert so much, and I wish I could go back, and I wish I could live there, but I can't because of what I've done. And I understand that I can't be there. Kind of opened this door for us to be connected around a kind of sense of exile and longing for a place that neither of us can return to. When you start to hear people's real stories and connect to your stories across identity, there are so many commonalities, you know. When I was in grad school, I read a speech by the film director who created Shoah, which is an epic film about the Holocaust. He gave a speech that came to be called The Obscenity of Understanding, in which he said, there is no way to understand. We must not understand. We cannot empathize. We cannot in any way justify what the Nazis did. And I refuse. I get it. And as an artist, I don't know that I can agree. As an artist, everything that I do is about trying to understand humans and why we do the things we do and what motivates us and how we can make different choices. So here I am, an Arab American, working with veterans, some of whom have served not only in Iraq, some in Afghanistan, some in Kuwait, some in the Gulf, some in Lebanon. And sometimes I confront this feeling that I am participating in the obscenity of understanding. And I have to ask myself again why I'm doing it and what I believe about our accountability for our actions and justice and forgiveness and healing. I also think it's really important that as artists who work in community that we examine our own tendencies to judge when we are dealing with the perpetration of violence. Because on some level, it might be easy for me to point a finger at a soldier and judge them for what they did in a combat situation, which I cannot even imagine and don't know how I would respond to, honestly. But they didn't do that alone. They did it through a whole system, a whole series of mechanisms, a whole history of systemic oppression that led them to join in the first place. It's much more complicated why people go into the military in the first place. Lots of people don't necessarily want to go to war. Lots of people are just trying to get an education or get out of a war zone at home, or are given the option of prison time or military service. Of course, communities of color and poor and working class communities are targeted the most for especially frontline military service. In fact, the majority of women veterans are African American. So all kinds of reasons that people go into the military. Once I started to understand that, I started to understand why we should be allies.
Before this bridge, back in 2012, Art to Action began a project in partnership with Carpetbag Theater that created an opportunity to develop a relationship with the veteran community.
Linda Paris Bailey invited me to direct their piece, Speed Killed My Cousin, which is about an African-American woman veteran who returns from Iraq and struggles with post-traumatic stress and moral injury. And it touches on a lot of other issues, such as the impact of multi-generational military service on African-American families particularly.
Andresia Mosley, a.k.a. Real, plays the lead, Deborah, in the touring production.
Basically, the piece is about Deborah being basically newly out and returning home to a family that has a history of family members being in the military, and she is having all of the symptoms of PTS and moral injury and trauma and all of these kind of things trying to return to civilian life. So she decides that she's going to take a drive to either clear her mind or kill herself. You really don't know. It's a long drive down the Long Island Expressway, and throughout this you begin to unfold, kind of like a peeling back an onion, what actually happened to her in the military. You know, all of the symptoms that she's dealing with, they basically manifest themselves on this drive.
Throughout the piece, Deborah interacts with members of her family who were also affected by war through military service. It's left up to the audience's interpretation whether these characters are really present or are part of Deborah's imagination.
I realized pretty quickly after reading the script that I needed to learn about post-traumatic stress and really understand what that is, how it functions, how it affects people, what the symptoms are, in order to direct a play in which the lead character, and actually multiple characters in the play, are struggling with it, even though the Vietnam-era vets in the play don't realize that that's what they have.
So research was reading, conducting interviews in story circles with veterans and doctors. Speed Killed My Cousin is about post-traumatic stress, but it is also about moral injury. For a more in-depth explanation, you could read the article Moral Injury Killed My Cousin, which is on the Alternate Roots website. PTS is related to what you survive. In the last 10 years or so, experts have dropped the disorder from the terminology for PTS because it has become more widely acknowledged that it is a natural response to trauma. Moral injury refers to the impact of actions witnessed or perpetrated by an individual that violate a deep moral belief.
Post-traumatic stress, in and of itself, is not necessarily a driver of suicide. Other things that go around along with it, like self-medicating or drug addiction or other things, might contribute to suicide, you know, things that are linked to PTS. Traumatic stress itself is not necessarily a driver of suicide, but moral injury is. We hear this statistic that there are now more suicides by veterans and active duty military than there are casualties in combat. And that has been the truth for several years running now, since I think maybe 2012. That's not only currently serving or recently returned veterans, that's also Vietnam-era veterans who are committing suicide in their 50s and 60s, and close to 70, some of them.
While they were preparing to tour Speed Killed My Cousin, Andrea learned of a Veterans Association clinic in Tampa with a drama group.
And I was like, what? A veteran drama group? It already exists? Like, I have to meet these folks. So I just called them up and made an appointment to go talk to them. And that was at the Tampa Veteran Recovery Center, or PRC. And PRC stands for Psychosocial Rehabilitation and Recovery Center. PRC is a program of the VA. It has national chapters associated with VA hospitals all over the country. And those are folks who have come out of a recent crisis situation, mental health crisis, very often attempted suicide. And as they get out of acute recovery, they are referred to a 2-year recovery program, which is the PRC. So the PRC in Tampa, under the leadership of Rachel Brink, is a particularly visionary program in terms of integrating the arts into the recovery process.
Andrea worked with doctors and veterans, and together they created theater workshops designed to aid in the recovery process. Now this has become a regular part of the programming at the PRRC, and the culture has grown comfortable with the process of theater. But this took time and effort. The first group she worked with there didn't know what to make of it.
And I was trying to get them to not only participate in a theater game, but then reflect on it and say how it made them feel and what feelings were coming up for them in the moment. One of the veterans who I could tell, you know, kind of had some leadership in the group, because everybody was just kind of standing there staring at me. And he said, "You realize that what you're asking us to do is the exact opposite of everything we've ever been trained to do." And I paused for a minute and I said, "Yes, I do realize that. And that's why I'm asking you to do it. Because you're in a recovery program. everything you've been trained to do isn't helping you take the next step that you need to take in your recovery. So I'm asking you to try something new that might feel really weird, and that's okay. And, you know, little by little, they started to do it and have fun doing it. I'll say one of the things I learned quickly about working with the VA is that there are a lot of things that people won't talk about on government property. Every VA facility is government property. There is a perception, whether it is true or not, that people might lose their services or in some way be punished if they say the wrong thing. I certainly don't think that that's true of the PRRC, but that is a fear that people have about the VA in general and about the military in general. And so once I understood that, I was like, okay, we need some kind of neutral space in which people can just feel like they don't have to censor themselves around their political beliefs, which is pretty much where the self-censorship happens at the VA. Different kind of self-censorship might happen in a public space, which might be about revealing too much about yourself or your recovery process. But at least we needed to offer a space that wasn't government, where we could invite people of all different political points of view into the same space. So, with the help of Sacred Grounds Coffee House in Tampa, we created a monthly Veterans Open Mic Night.
Greetings.
Greetings.
How y'all doing? Me personally, I'm doing all right, y'all. It works if you work it.
It actually, I think, kind of started as a Roots Rhizome event, and then we had the idea to make it a monthly event. So, you know, like any open mic, it's open to anyone in the community, and we encourage local artists to perform. Sometimes we feature local artists or national guest artists when we have them in town. And we were really building the veteran programming at the same time that we were doing this bridge. So working with veterans was kind of a regular part of most of our This Bridge residencies, which was a totally new experience for a lot of the Arab and Muslim artists that we were bringing to town, but also we were really curious about what would happen, what would be the potential benefits of bringing Arab or Muslim identified artists into the veteran space, which wound up consistently being something that surprised the artists themselves, that, you know, they didn't know how they'd feel about it going in, and wound up finding it a very interesting or rewarding experience and talking about it in their exit interviews.
In addition to acting in Speed Killed My Cousin, Real also hosts the open mic.
So the Veterans Open Mic is a platform to, one, show appreciation for veterans, but also to enable them to have like a venue of expression. For the community, it just really keeps a focus on a group that they really don't deal with on a consistent basis. Most of the time, as far as like the other poets and the other artists here, there's really no interaction specifically with veterans. No, you know, specific work that we're doing necessarily with the military. So the open mic actually presents an opportunity for us to kind of meet each other, and you find out that a lot of the veterans are quite creative and you have more things in common than that, you know, initial distance or lack of working together. So I hope what it becomes is just a place where both groups or all groups of the community can kind of come together and use art as a forum to connect to each other.
The War and Treaty is a band that has appeared at the open mic as a featured artist. They are founded by Michael Trotter Jr., who is a veteran, and his wife, Tanya Blunt. Real remembers a moment from one show they did in November 2016. They were joined by cellist Philman Benham.
I had invited, just being a part of the Tampa community, a large portion of the Tampa arts community in specifically for that Veterans Open Mic. And so the crowd was huge, and they did a song called Dear Martha, which has to do with the passing away of someone that's very close to Michael in the military. It was kind of like the guy that took care of him, told he was going to be all right during the whole thing. Anyway, long story short, the song is about him being killed during war, and it's kind of like Michael's dedication to it.
I met a soldier off at Warriors. He was far away. He had three kids, a faithful wife, and Martha was her name.
As the song was playing, we were all crying. And I think that after a while, it kind of became less about, you know, someone specifically dying in the military as much as it became about, like, losing someone who, you know, seemed to always, like, kind of be like your guardian or take care of you. And there's, like, this common feeling of that loss just throughout the whole entire Veterans Open Mic. So I think that was maybe one moment where those worlds came together and, you know, shared, you know, the same emotion.
Real says working on the open mic opened her up to a deeper understanding of people with experience in war. Playing Deborah in Speed Killed My Cousin was an entirely different kind of education.
I had about 2 weeks to learn the script initially, and I kind of shut off from every world but the military. I watched so much war, and it was the very first time I had ever seen it. It was unbelievable what was available for me to see about it. You know, people's body parts being blown up and, you know, things just happening that I really visually had never seen, heard, never witnessed. That, yeah, it traumatized me. I think that for that character, I needed to experience some areas of emotions that, I mean, quite frankly, I never, ever gone into. I had already been interacting through Veterans Open Mic, but I wasn't on that level to them and they weren't on that level to me. And it's like when The Secret came out, I'm like, hey, I'm trying to be you guys in a play. There was a different way that they treated me and a different way that I treated them as a result when it came to the Veterans Open Mic. It was like a different type of connection. And I was really surprised because I thought it would be offensive or they would be defensive, you know, because I don't have military background. I'm not a veteran. You know, I don't have any connection that I really know of, but they were so supportive in me being accurate, and it was almost like these little small conversations that were happening at the Veterans Open Mic, like, yeah, this is what it's really like. I think even the course of some of the things that they began to share were for my benefit. They started to tell more of their own trauma, and I think really for, you know, a couple of the open mics, they were trying to help me out. They were trying to help me get it right. And so that was just very different as far as support one to another, you know. While in the show, I think the main thing for me was just reminding myself that I wasn't in the military. It was very odd to be in company or right after the show or right before the show to convince myself that this wasn't my trauma. And when I got around other veterans, I was feeling connected to them in a way that I was like, but it's not, I can tell sometimes if it was real or it wasn't, you know. It's like I felt so much more connected to them than my actual experience had given me. And it was this character, you know, that I would tell them sometimes. I was like, I think Deborah's showing up like right now. And it had to do with being around them or when their stories started and things like that. Like, I could feel myself getting sometimes a little panicky and a little, you know, stronger in disposition and everything. And it's just, it was very transformative. And I'll say that when I interact with veterans, there's this amount of respect that is Deborah's, that even though I'm not currently doing the role, is still very much so present.
There was a moment that was really memorable for me when Real came to do a workshop and visit the PRRC group, and we were having a conversation. And there was this one moment when an older man in the group who was African-American, and he was a Vietnam era vet, he asked Real, like, how do you come out of it? How do you put it down? I want to know because I can't. So how does an actor do that? PTS is actually treatable and healable. You can recover from PTS. So it's not like a neurological disorder such as schizophrenia, which you just have to learn to cope and live with. You do have to learn to cope and live with PTS, but you can actually heal from it over time if you have some kind of process or treatment to do that. If you don't, it gets worse over time. And that's the thing that nobody talks about. That's why Vietnam vets are killing themselves in their 60s, right? And that's also why one of the things that General Steele said that really struck me was he explained that to me, and he said, we are not going to see the full effects of PTS from these wars until 2030. Why is this work important? Because we want to get ahead of the curve. We don't want to get to 2030 and see all these folks committing suicide, right? We need to have a way to tell these stories and to offer treatment and to have ways to heal now. If I don't believe in the possibility of healing, I can't believe in the possibility of change. And if I don't believe that their stories are important for the rest of the world to hear, then how will we ever get the truth about what we have done in the Middle East and in the world? And I also think, like you were saying, that if we do tell these stories, then we have a way for society to heal and society to say, we're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to vote for the next war because nobody wins.
Nobody wins.
For more information on Art to Action, visit art2action.org.
Creating Place is an audio exploration of placemaking. It is part of a larger project by Alternate Roots called Creating Place, the Art of Equitable Community Building, a multimedia collection of reflections on the history and current practices of creative placemaking in the U.S. South. For more on the project and Alternate Roots, visit www.alternateroots.org.
Creating Place was recorded by me, Bonnie Gable, and edited by me and Free For All, with additional support from Hannah Pepper Cunningham. Music and soundscaping by Free For All.
You also heard music today from The War and Treaty. You can find their music at thewarandtreaty.com. And from Cotton, you can find him down at the Veterans Open Mic. You also heard some music remixed from the soundtracks of 11 Reflections on September and 9 Parts of Desire.
Funding for Creating Place, the Art of Equitable Community Building, comes from the National Endowment for the Arts, Our Town program.